40 The reason the CTRs are here, Stefano told me, is to study us because they understand that there is a difference between them and us. They were created, I don't know where, and distributed in the universe. They want to understand how to cover the gap between themselves and us. 41. The CTRs, encountered by Stefano and his colleagues on a number of occasions, created divisions within Amicizia. On several occasions, for example, doppelganger of some of the participants supposedly were produced to sow confusion and dissension among the group. Some, including Bruno Gibordi, even left the group, no longer able to cope with the situation. Our colleagues were not able to adhere to the teachings of our friends, and our group started to disintegrate, explained Bruno Samasicchia. The CTRs, little by little, were seizing the opportunity, altering documents, changing memories, even wiping out somebody's memories. As easily as if they were showing a movie, greater than 42, discrediting of participants, supposedly initiated by the CTRs, was rife. Owing to his wealth, apparently, Bruno Samasicchia was once falsely accused of having swindled an elderly couple of money. The case came to court and Bruno was convicted. He appealed the sentence, however, and in December 2000 was proclaimed totally innocent of all charges. 43. In November 1978, the whole central part of the Adriatic Sea erupted, as confirmed in numerous contemporary news reports, some of which are reproduced in the book. It lasted a full couple of months, Stefano reported. Huge columns of water tens of meters high suddenly arose, unprecedented waves and strange lights were seen at night, and both civilian and military radars got unexplained echoes. One fishing boat sank inexplicably, with the loss of two fishermen, though they had not died from drowning. The results of the autopsies conducted on their bodies were never released, and fishing activity stopped almost completely. In the meantime, over land and sea, hundreds of UFOs and their occupants were seen by all kinds of people, from policemen to farmers. 44 What on earth was happening? Far beneath the seabed along this stretch of the Adriatic lay one of the W-56's larger bases, at a depth of about 12 miles from the surface. Paolo Di Girolamo writes as follows, the CTRs were able to enter and destroy most of the W-56's bases, with casualties on both sides, including the largest one, which stretched from Ortona to Rimini, and from the center of the Adriatic to the center of Italy. The W-56s themselves had forecast, you'll see waters rising, and boiling over the place where we have built our big base. 45. Stefano was skeptical about the reasons for this scenario. Officially, there had been a terrible battle between the CTRs and the W-56s, he told me. The latter said they had been defeated and went away, promising that they would return at the beginning of the new century. That's the official version. My opinion is that, on the contrary, it was false information in order to justify their interruption of the contact with Bruno and his group. Because, actually, they never went away. 46. Stefano related to me two experiences he had while flying in aircraft, the first of which occurred near Laquan on May 17, 1981, entered in his pilot's logbook, which I examined. I was piloting a Seafalk 70-powered glider, registration IMARD, at an altitude of about 1,000 meters above the ground, when a fast-flying disc, stone-colored, flew below my starboard wing, generating a great deal of turbulence. My starboard wing went up. The nose went up, and I was in an incipient spin. Probably for structural reasons, that aircraft could not do a spin. So I applied full power, full right rudder, pushed the stick forward, and the aircraft got back to normal. But all the way back to Laquan I continued to be in strong turbulence. Usually, UFOs do not affect the atmosphere in this way, therefore Stefano believes the craft was based on aerodynamic principles. However, there have been occasions when severe turbulence and other disturbing effects have been encountered by planes confronted with craft of non-aerodynamic shape, such as those reported in Ireland in 2004.47. Stefano's other experience occurred in 1997, as a passenger. At that time, he told me, I was working in Cordoba, Argentina, so typically was flying from Rome to Madrid, then Madrid to Buenos Aires, and from there to Cordoba. On that occasion in 1997, I was flying in a Boeing 747, which I knew to be an old plane. As managing director of my company, I was flying first class. We were probably in the mid-Atlantic, when all of a sudden there was a sudden movement of the aircraft, not turbulence, as though something was wrong. At the time, I was listening to some classical music. Then Sages, one of the aliens I had known, announced via the headphones, "Don't worry. We have the situation under control." When we landed at Buenos Aires the next morning, as we disembarked from the plane, I noticed on the port wing that a panel, about 333 feet, was missing on the upper side. I guessed it was metal fatigue, but normally, had that been the case, all the other panels would have gone too. The corrupted airflow should have taken away the other panels, depriving the wing of lift. But it was just that one. That means they were looking after me. So, you see, they never went away. 48. To further confuse the issue, according to Bruno Samasixia, there was yet another group of ETs operating during this period, which he called the UTI. I don't know what he meant with those initials, Stefano writes in his treatise, but UTI was a group in a way on a higher level than the W-56s and CTRs, whose activities they were supervising, taking action when they believed that one of the two groups was going beyond certain limits. Once, the UTIs reproached the W-56s for something they'd done, and Bruno was seen weeping because he couldn't accept that his friends had been reprimanded. According to Stefano, an Austrian general he knew was among those in regular contact with the UTIs. 49. Physiognomy, clothing, and customs. From a physiological point of view, the W-56s are roughly identical to us, Bruno learned. They breathe oxygen, though they need a slightly higher percentage than we do. Most of the oxides in our atmosphere are poisonous to them, so they take some substances that enable them to safely metabolize those oxides. Their blood is identical to ours, has the same color, only there are many more proteins. The main difference consists in their liver, which changes its dimensions and functions according to the environment. Acting like a sponge, when its services are not required, it atrophies to the size of a fist. When they live here on Earth, their liver is very active and works as a filter for the toxins they receive in our environment. Their legs and arms are very strong, and their brain is somewhat larger than ours, but they maintain that this doesn't necessarily imply that they are more intelligent than us. Most of the aliens with whom Bruno liaised had blonde hair, and a few, black with a bluish tinge. Hair and eyelashes were thicker than ours, and some of the men sported stiff beards. Their eyes are gray, blue, and some black with a bluish hue. Their hands are slim, just like their bodies, with long fingers ending in nails that are some 4 or 5 millimeters longer than ours. 50. The W-56 aliens do not use water to clean themselves. According to Bruno, they enter a kind of unit in which they are engulfed in vibrations, resulting in foam that exudes from their body, rendering them totally clean. Their suits are living entities that adapt themselves to the body they cover. This is a strictly personal process, Stefano points out. One cannot wear the clothes of someone else. Once a month, the suits are purified within a peculiar machine for a few minutes. 51. Defecation apparently occurs only once a week. They slept only 2 or 3 hours a night. Dimpietro, and probably others like him who claim to have spent several centuries on Earth, slept for longer. 52. Mating is the same as on Earth, though apparently they often use a form of artificial insemination and the child is born in a special device. 53. According to Stefano and others, they are totally compatible in this respect. Some have even interbred with Earth humans, directly over their skin. A very tight overall was worn, a second skin intended to protect their body against adverse temperatures, while also eliminating bodily impurities and preventing toxins from reaching their skin, Bruno learned. Over the skin they wore a one-piece suit, tight at the neck, wrists, and ankles, ending with shoes that formed part of the suit, and soles some 5 centimeters thick. These suits were colored, usually in every hue of gray, green, red, and blue, sometimes white, with a rigid collar often bordered with pale orange on the neck. They seemed to attach importance to the color of their clothes when making important decisions. For example, they would wear translucent, almost pearl-colored suits with moving colors, perhaps similar to shot silk. 54. No government, as such, exists. Neither do the W56s possess a formal civil code. As a highly developed people, they know instinctively how to behave. Our formalities are unknown to them. They do not have lawyers, courts, or the like, Bruno explains. To them, doing evil is plain absurd. They cannot lie, they cannot hurt anybody, nor anything. 55. According to Stefano, however, in some circumstances killing can be justified. One of the W56s once told me that it is not fundamentally evil to kill a man, within certain contexts. He says. 56. As for their religious attitudes, Bruno, the Catholic scholar, reports that they see God in everything, from the smallest insect to the cosmos. Their religion is not as full of rituals as are ours. To them, it is just a deep feeling, he writes. 57. Stefano believes their creed is similar to that of classical yoga philosophy. I concur. Having read numerous books on these matters since my student days, I have always been particularly drawn to this philosophy. 58. Although respecting whatever creed of our planet, wrote Stefano, the W56s maintained that there is no need for rituals, worship, or asking for grace. God is within us. 59. The W56s speak a wide variety of our languages and are adept in numerous dialects. The man interviewed on tape by Stefano in Bologna, for example, was fluent in Chinese, English, German, Hindi, Italian, Latin, Russian, and Sanskrit. 60. Regarding Sanskrit, Stefano gave me some splendid examples of references to cosmic vehicles and spaceships in the Gvida Samhita, including the following. O twin leaders, your objective is clear, you have thrown open the routes of space. The pilots of your spaceship have harnessed engines for your onward journey, the engines that take you safely, without accidents. Both of you have been conveniently seated in your richly decorated three-shafted craft, going along a direct path through space. 61. Many of Stefano's experiences and projects were shared with his friend Giancarlo, the accountant mentioned earlier. But the lengthy contacts took their toll. Eventually Stefano terminated his participation with the W56s, as it began to impact on his professional career. You cannot live a quiet life when you are regularly meeting aliens, he explained to me, and after 40 years I decided to quit. 62. In addition to the material cited in this summary, Mass Contacts features an interesting foreword by Roberto Pinotti, one of Europe's leading investigators. Though not directly involved with the W56s, he became aware that something exotic was going on in 1969, while studying political science at the University of Florence. At the time he was also General Secretary of Centro Ufologico Nazionale, a leading Italian group. He learned from his professor that an underground alien base existed near Pescara, information acquired from important and well-connected sources. 63. In Mass Contacts, Stefano Breccia also includes a very interesting background history relating to various extraordinary individuals, including George Washington, who over the centuries seem to have been inspired by advanced beings from elsewhere. He also writes about some of the post-World War II contactees, such as George Adamski, Truman Bethlehem, Dan Fry, and George Hunt Williamson, and devotes about 90 pages to the so-called Ammo Affair. The latter is a complex and sometimes seemingly ridiculous saga beginning in 1965, when hundreds of physicists, engineers, biologists, astronomers, and selected people all over the world interested in the subject, including Stefano, began receiving strange letters from these people, individually typed, in many different languages, though primarily in Spanish. The information and diagrams covered mostly scientific and technical aspects of their craft, plus aspects of their culture and language, and much else besides. Like a number of other researchers, I remain skeptical about the Ummites, though I retain an open mind. Stefano shares my skepticism about many aspects. However, he describes personal experiences in mass contacts that tend to suggest that, like the W56S, something quite extraordinary was going on, which simply can't be a hoax, by Earth humans, at least. With regard to the Amicizia saga, Stefano wisely cautions us not to take everything at face value. He was concerned, for example, when the W56S requested some of their contacts, including himself, to bring them certain potentially harmful substances related to their technology. As Hans explains, they use a lot of mercury in most of their applications, so that Earthlings trying to duplicate their technology had to cope with this metal. Horesco reference, a device based on a nitrogen plasma generator, with mercury pipes, that became solid thanks to a liquid air envelope. Mercury is an expensive substance, not readily found in great quantities, moreover a toxic substance. We have also been working with asbestos and radioactive compounds such as radium, barium, strontium, niobate, and with hypervoltage generators, beyond 1 megavolt, so we were used to being careful. 64. Who knows if there is anyone who actually understands the knowledge of what Amicizia has meant, in toto? Asks Stefano. Who knows how many persons, all over Central Europe, are acquainted with it? Too many have died during this period, even those foreign to it, too many people went mad, and too many have ruined their lives. 65. Recently, in delving through one of my files containing correspondence between George Adamski and his Swiss representative Louise Lusenstag, by happenstance I chanced on an Amicizia connection. I want you to know what a singular experience I had during a short visit to Italy, Lou wrote to Adamski in July 1962. A very good journalist named Bruno Gibordi wrote a whole series of articles in one paper, publishing all kinds of intriguing contact stories and also photos from other people. Among them were those of a young artist, Gaspar de Lama, from Milano, which were so interesting that I wrote to him. My Italian being rather poor, I asked a friend of mine, Kurt Zach, to accompany me to de Lama. We met him, his wife, and his mother. They are very sincere and trustworthy people, poor but of good breeding, well-educated and hospitable. De Lama tells an amazing story. He forbade me to write to anybody about it except you. His first question was regarding your pamphlet on the spaceships being useful in case of cosmic wars. He had heard this from Alberto Perigo through a friend, but was not sure. When I confirmed it and said that Adamski took this seriously, he murmured, "I knew that Adamski is no fool." He then proceeded to show us his photos. This man has been able to photograph saucers since February 1962, in 7 series, one of them in color. A friend of mine pilots them and sometimes lets me know when they're coming and where I can take pictures. He is an Italian like me, called Franco. He works with people from another galaxy. These people have subterranean bases here on Earth. I asked him why his space friends were here and why they hid under the Earth. In the first place, he explained that they are kind of like military people and would have to hide everywhere. They are not here to make war on us, they came to fight, not with weapons, a bad race who came to this planet some time ago in order to force us to make war with each other. He himself has not yet had any contact, but Franco gave him some letters written by space people. They look most intriguing, though, did not much resemble the letter from Venus which you showed me here in Bile. CP 113. I was all the more astonished when de Lama added, "Almost with your own words, you see, those signs are whole sentences. Such a letter may contain the contents of a whole book." In Alien Base, I alluded to the testimony of Gibordi, citing a series of photographs he had taken of alien craft on the shores of the Adriatic coast in Pescara in April 1961. One of which shows a bizarre-looking craft with what appear to be wings and fins set at a non-aerodynamically high dihedral angle, see photo section. A respected science journalist, Gibordi was a familiar figure on Italian television and radio at the time, specializing mostly in aerospace matters. Later that year, he was introduced to several of the W-56 aliens, with witnesses present. They explained that although nuclear weapons remained one of the principal reasons for their increased presence, there were other reasons he was forbidden from disclosing. The alleged conflict with the CTRs undoubtedly being one, I would assume. Gabaldi learned that the aliens' reluctance to reveal themselves more openly was based not only on the danger that would ensue from public panic, but that their open appearance among Earth people would inevitably lead to negative comparisons. Do not let us forget, he pointed out, that between their science and ours there is a gap of thousands of years, and for this reason an official mass descent of space beings from other planets would inevitably bring about comparisons between their worlds and ours, and, there are cosmic laws which prevent the more evolved races from interfering, beyond certain limits, in the evolution and development of the more backward races. 66, Chapter 14, Alternative Spacecraft. Early one evening in November 1950, 18-year-old William Blackie Rawlison and his schoolmate Tommy Brown were hunting on North Merritt Island, west of Cape Canaveral, Florida. Suddenly, they heard a noise winding up like a turbine emanating from the southeast. Rawlison told Florida Today reporter Billy Cox that a radial wing aircraft approached slowly from about 2 miles away until it was directly overhead, some 60 feet off the ground. He estimated that it was about 90 to 100 feet in diameter. Behind the aircraft's 12 to 14 foot high windows of bluish tinted glass could be seen about a 28 foot long console cabinet with instrumentation, Rawlison recalled, as well as six human appearing crew members, wearing light blue looking flight suits with square, black collars, about 6 inches high. The crewman he saw most clearly had reddish blonde hair. It looked like a crew cut, he told Cox. The vehicle glowed from the inside, but had no running lights. The only exterior light was a 14-inch diameter hole on the bottom that was this solid, flaming red. But there was no exhaust coming from it. The encounter lasted about 4 minutes. Then it took off real fast, to the northeast, said Rawlison. There's not a day goes by that I don't think about what I saw. 65 years old when he gave this interview in 1997. He was then the owner of two light aircraft and had been a pilot for 40 years. What makes Rawlison's tale a bit different from the rest, Billy Cox points out, is its location, North Merritt Island, just west of modern-day Kennedy Space Center, roughly 4 months after the United States entered the rocket era with ignition of the bumper sequence from the Cape, one that was in July 1950. Although launch pads 1 to 4 were then barely under construction at Cape Canaveral, the Army scheduled launches of two modified German V-2 bumper rockets as first stage and a without any control, what corporal rocket as second stage. To the space program was underway, and it was constantly monitored by beings from elsewhere. Rawlison's early description of a red-haired alien is supported by the testimony of others, such as the Native American friend of Kyle Anderson, Chapter 7, and by Apollina, Paul, Villa, also Chapter 7, who had encounters with aliens in the 1950s and 1960s. In June 1963, for example, he witnessed the landing of a large disc in New Mexico from which emerged 4 men and 5 women, ranging in height from 7 to 9 feet. Some had red hair. 3. In December 1959, Omar Boley, of COCO, worked as a blockhouse and pad inspector for Northrop, mainly during the Snark rocket tests. Off duty, having pulled over in his car to watch a late night launch not far from pads 3 and 4, reports Billy Cox, Boley watched as three glowing objects, with edges slanted like pie plates and if you turned one upside down on top of the other, descended upon the launch area from the north. As Boley reports, they were in a triangle formation, one in the lead, two in back. They were off-white in color, I guess, and absolutely noiseless. It was astounding. When the rocket launched, the first one turned over on its side in a vertical position and followed it, then the second vehicle followed, then the third, in single file. One was near the front, another was near the middle, and the other was near the back end. They all went out of sight together. There was one other fella pulled over at the time. He was in a Jeep, sort of a mustard color. I remember he looked at me and said, "You didn't see anything at all, nothing occurred here. If you say anything, you'll be in deep trouble." So I didn't say anything. But I never forgot it. 4. Clandestine Rendezvous. In June 1967, NASA's John F. Kennedy Space Center issued an ambiguously worded management instruction from Director Kurt H. Debus, applicable to all organizational elements, to establish procedures for handling reports of sightings of objects such as fragments or component parts of space vehicles known or alleged by an observer to have impacted the Earth's surface. Included are reports of sightings of objects not related to space vehicles. Under definitions, A, and, B, the latter specifies unidentified flying objects. Procedures for handling reports included the instruction, "Under no circumstances will the origin of the object be discussed with the observer." UFO reports per se were to be reported to Patrick Air Force Base, Florida, Command Post. 5. In late December 1967, Jim Oglesby lived in Orlando, Florida, working as a clerk in the machine shop at the Bendix Corporation Launch Support and Logistics Office modules at the Kennedy Space Center. His brother-in-law, John Baker, had invited him to join his family for New Year's Eve weekend celebrations at their mobile home in Bithlow, 18 miles east of Orlando. On the early evening of December 30, John and Jim were chatting in the kitchen while the family watched a classic Christmas movie in the living room. Suddenly, a flash of amber light reflected through the kitchen window that faced east, Jim reports in his book. I reached around and flung wide the front door, my heart pounding, as I expected to see a meteor hit the ground. Instead, my attention was drawn to an amber basketball-sized swirling mass, suspended in midair less than 100 feet above and east of the mobile home. At first glance, I thought, it might have been the phenomenon known as ball lightning. The mysterious anomaly maintained the estimated 100 feet distance, however, just before it vanished, its amber color illuminated the upper round structure, the underside, and the lower outer rim of a pewter metallic craft that measured perhaps 45 to 50 feet in diameter. The unknown craft glided soundlessly as it banked and headed due east, and vanished. Both John and Jim's sister also witnessed this event. At one point, a beam of deep red cone-shaped light emanated from beneath the craft, tracing the ground as it continued eastward. The red beam winked out, then on, then off again, Jim continues. I concluded that whether remote-controlled or piloted by an occupant, the craft was under intelligent control and beyond our technology. Then a pattern of flashing red lights appeared where the red beam had just winked out, just above the shadowy tree line that lined up within the two poles that flanked the driveway. I stood in amazement as I watched the configuration of flashing red lights rotate in a 6-5-4-3-2-1-1-2-3-4-5-6 pattern around the outer perimeter of a solid structure. Moments later, a second craft with an identical band of flashing red lights that flashed to and fro around the craft's middle, floated in from the left and glided alongside its companion. Now, the flashing red lights that rotated back and forth around the middle of each unidentified craft did not conform to any terrestrial navigational protocol that I had ever observed on aircraft before. Both craft hung there in the air just above the tree line. Then the craft on the left rose and, on cue, the second one descended. Then the twosome reversed the process and, in one harmonious rhythmic motion, both craft floated and swayed back and forth, like leaves caught on the wind, as they dropped below the dark topography. As both ships descended, the frequency of the red lights increased back and forth in a horizontal pattern around the middle of each, and as the twosome dropped out of sight there was a moment of awe as I stared out there where something most extraordinary had just happened. I was not close enough to see the saucers touch the ground, but I watched the flashing red lights through the open space between the stand of trees in the distance, until the flashing red lights dropped out of sight. At that point, it was speculation if the two unknowns had touched down. A short while after, six helicopters, believed to have been AH-1G Huey Cobras, fanned out in another widening circle, their bright beams, directed, on the dark terrain below as they moved back and forth above the general area for 3 or 4 minutes, while two F-106A Delta DART jets, also, flew low over the UFO target's area.